channelradio.co.uk. Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to Money Talk, the new show from Channel Radio looking at financial matters. My name is Simon Webster, and my day job is as a financial advisor to both private individuals and businesses. I'm here today with Paul Andrews, who presents the excellent Business Bunker on Tuesdays. He is here helping me with the buttons and stands ready to fill in if I dry up.
Hello, good morning, Paul. Simon. How are you?
Extremely well. Isn't it lovely today?
It's a gorgeous day down here on the marsh, isn't it? It's a tad warm in the studio, of course, but we'll probably go for a paddle later to cool down.
That sounds like a very good idea to me. You know what? I needed a calculator, but I recently worked out that I've actually been a financial advisor for over 35 years.
Good grief. You don't look old enough.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I tell myself for that when I look in the mirror in the morning, but it doesn't seem to work. My firm now looks after over £80 million of client money. So listeners know a little bit about me, both of them. On the personal front, I've been married to my beautiful wife and business partner, Pam, for 30 years, and we have three wonderful grown-up children and three fantastic grandchildren. We also have a cat who occasionally deigns to answer to promise. It says on the Channel Radio website that Pam and I live in Wye, which for the last 25 years has been true. But next Tuesday, we're moving to a little village between Liminge and Hythe called Postling. I hear I shall be in good company, but we'll have to update the site. This is the inaugural outing for the Money Talk show, and the team here at Channel Radio is really excited as we launch. If you're not already on the Channel Radio website at www.channelradio.co.uk, do please take yourself there and click on the presenters button, and then click onto page number 2, and you'll see a picture of yours truly, which at the moment has the singular distinction of being the only presenter picture on the whole website that is in glorious Technicolor. I also think I'm right in saying that I'm the only presenter wearing a tie. Tyler's Paul is, of course, on page 1 in black and white. We'll shortly be launching a Money Talk website where we'll be keeping an archive of the shows as we go along, and you can contact us through our Twitter feed at hashtag MoneyTalk underscore guru, or email me at sw@fffp.co.uk with any questions, queries or comments. But please feel free to save any abuse for Paul. On a show with a name like Money Talk, it seems logical to try and address current financial issues, and there are a fair few subjects to choose from. We'll start with the English preoccupation, the housing market. I mentioned earlier that we're moving for the first time in 25 years next week, and it seems that a lot of other people have had the same idea. But according to Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England, there remain concerns that the housing market is overheating. And he hinted earlier this week that interest rates may rise sooner than many people expect. Although he stressed, and he did stress this, that such rises would be modest and the speed of any increases quite slow. In truth, Mr. Carney attributes the need for interest rate rises to more general economic recovery than any sort of housing bubble, which in any case seems to be limited to central London and one or two other hotspots, rather than a national rise. And here, an interjection. The other big thing in the housing market recently has been the Mortgage Market Review, or MMR. Have you heard about that, Paul?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's been something that's been brought up by the financial regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority.
Right.
And the outcome of this has been that all new lending has to be underwritten far, far, far more thoroughly than it ever used to be. The idea being that people don't get loans they can't afford.
Oh, right. Yes. No, I did hear about that. Yep.
And it means, of course, that we all have to jump through far more hoops if we want to borrow money.
Mm.
Now, in truth, that's probably a good thing overall.
Sure.
Banks shouldn't be handing out large sums of money to people who can't afford to repay. Mm. But some may find the degree of detail that banks are now demanding on our personal financial arrangements quite intrusive. And do we trust our banks with so much data?
Well, you know, it fascinated me when I heard about this, Simon, because the government's argument for this is they don't want people to overextend themselves with debt, fair enough. But in the same breath, they were saying that that the housing market is overheating and it's difficult to get on a housing ladder. Yeah. So surely if you're going to stop people having mortgages, it's going to make it even harder.
Well, it's that between a rock and a hard place bit, because, of course, the housing market is getting quite warm, but it's only getting warm in London and the South East.
Exactly, yeah.
And in large areas of the Midlands and the North and other places, it's not doing so well. Yeah. I mean, it's doing particularly well in Aberdeen, I heard the other day, of all places, but, of course, the oil industry is booming up there.
Yeah, sure.
But it's a huge issue. And the real concern is that while higher interest rates depress the housing market, which has for a long time been the engine of the UK economy, actually, far more importantly, it makes it more expensive for businesses to borrow. So you have higher interest rates, businesses can't borrow, and that starts to choke off the recovery. Mm. Because if people at home are feeling not very confident about taking on a loan and increasing their debt because they're worried interest rates are going to go up, and at the same time businesses are getting nervous about investment, then we have economic disaster again and the whole economy ends back in the doldrums. Mm. While we're on the economy, an observation. I'm probably on thin ice here, but I think the Coalition has done pretty well in stoking recovery in the UK. Whatever your politics, the recovery here in the UK is, to my mind, a real vindication of a lot of the policies that we've had over here. I get really cross when I hear people say, but what about the people who've seen their standard of living eroded as they haven't had any pay rises? Well, from a personal point of view, that's really quite sad. And I'm sure we all know lots of people who are really struggling. Mm. But I've just got back from Europe and I was in Italy, and the poverty out there and people without jobs and the whole economy is in serious trouble. And across huge swathes of the world, there is still only slow, zero, or even negative growth. Mm. And generally, these are countries which have continued to spend money they didn't have, and they've ended up like Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, and they're called the pigs for a reason, and their economies are in a real state. So it's that real balancing act, and you've got to do it when you put the interest rates up. If you put interest rates up, it's probably a good thing for a whole pile of reasons, but you run the risk of choking off the economy. And if you don't put them up, then you've got issues with the housing market overheating, and the Bank of England and the Chancellor have got a real balancing act. But at least it's a problem of success to some degree, rather perhaps than a problem of failure.
It did make me laugh, Simon, actually, Mark Carney, and I did try to warn against this. When Mark Carney first took over, and he made a very rash announcement that should unemployment fall below 7%, they would put interest rates up.
Yeah.
And I said to him, that's going to happen, because he didn't think it was. And I said, it will happen, because you do not understand unemployment. And they went, well... And of course, in very short order, we're now down to 6.8% unemployment.
Exactly.
And as you were saying about the pigs, in Europe, the average rate of unemployment is 25% amongst the pigs. And in Spain, it's 54% of under 24s are unemployed.
Which is terrifying, isn't it?
Which is terrifying. The only two countries in Europe that have reasonable unemployment rates are the UK at 6.8 and Germany at 5.9. Everybody else is in double digits.
And you should know because you run an employment website.
Exactly,
don't you?
Yeah.
So that's just sort of a little bit of economic news, a little foray into things that are current. Our show today will focus on retirement, and it's a huge subject. Future editions will take a more detailed look at different types of pensions, investments, equity release, and many other issues that will have a profound impact on the quality of our lives in retirement. But today we're going to try and look at the subject of retirement a bit more generally. Are you thinking of retiring anytime soon, Paul?
Well, I keep talking about it, but I don't think it's going to happen, to be quite honest, Simon.
Yeah, you and me both, mate. I think that's about the size of it. We still both got a little bit of time to go yet.
Yeah.
So who should be thinking about retirement? How do you know when you're ready to retire? I've heard it said that when you bend down and start looking for other things to do when you're down there, then maybe it's time you should really start to think about it. But who knows? Generally speaking, one tends to imagine that old people, particularly those over 60 or 65, like Paul, should be thinking about their retirement. But if you leave it until 60 to start thinking about it, you've definitely left it too late for proper planning. But there are still things that even those aged 60 plus can do to bolster their retirement incomes. So you'd be okay, Paul.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. I'm pleased about that.
Well, we do our best.
While I'm down here, would you?
The reality, though, is that planning retirement needs to start when you first start work. And for some of us, that was a few years ago. So if you've not already been tempted to turn off because you're aged under 50 and you see retirement as simply too far away for you to bother, and that thinking about retirement is reserved for people who are much older than you, haven't got any hair and they're starting to dribble a bit, like Paul, then perhaps you should continue listening. When the state benefit system was first introduced at the end of the Second World War, the state retirement age was set at 65 for males and 60 for females. Average life expectancy thereafter was about 10 years. So the state could afford a reasonable pension over that 10-year term, and there were plenty of younger people working and paying tax to support those relatively few retirees. Now, with so many of us living far longer, and with those numbers still rising, there is a huge and increasing burden on the state. Now you work from age 20 to age 65, or maybe a little bit later these days, you retire, and then you could easily live to age 100. And I've got a couple of stats on that in a minute. That's only 45 years of work to fund 35 years of retirement.
That's scary, isn't it?
It is.
That is really scary.
Well, it should start focusing people's minds. That extra life expectancy means that we all have to find more money to live on in retirement. This means we need to be saving up for most of our working lives, because if we don't, when we get to retirement, there simply won't be enough to live on. But the problem, of course, is always there's something else to spend your money on.
Absolutely.
You've got to buy a house or rent somewhere. You've got to pay for a wedding and raise kids and sort out their education and pay for their university. You've always got to keep yourself in a job, and you've got to find some way of balancing your financial issues. It's a real problem. Some might say sadly, but the other day I found myself looking at some figures issued by the Office for National Statistics. Sadly, I do that sort of thing in my spare time. They predicted that 1/3 of babies born in the UK in 2013 are expected to live to age 100.
Right.
1/3.
Good grief.
Yeah.
That has massive implications on lots of things.
Well, doesn't it? Doesn't it? I mean, I think Saga will be in become even more successful.
Do you think they'll have to redo their model and have it for the over 90s or something?
Well, it'd be very interesting. There might be a Saga Plus for the really old. Yeah. I then did some digging around, and the improbably named Oxford Institute for Ageing. Did you know there was an Institute for Ageing?
Oh, I had no idea.
I think you and I ought to join. But they published a report in 2011 entitled Living Longer and Prospering.
Oh.
I was drawn by the nod to Star Trek in its title.
Yeah.
But joking aside, the Institute publishes some interesting statistics on the design of what they call an adequate, sustainable and equitable UK state pension system. Quoting now from their executive summary, they conclude, "The population of the United Kingdom is ageing." Well, there's a surprise. "Steep declines in mortality in middle and later life mean we have a much better chance of living to claim the state pension and then to receive it for much longer than has ever previously been the case. Fertility rates..." That's a lovely one. "Fertility rates have been below replacement level for more than 40 years.
Wow.
So there's less young people. And as we age, there are fewer individuals in subsequent generations paying contributions to finance the growing outgo. The UK state pension system has undergone reforms aimed at addressing this demographic challenge." That's a lovely word, demographics. "However, unless we can encourage a greater economic activity amongst older workers, we risk the state pension becoming unsustainable." Now that was a real wake-up call.
Mm.
We risk the state pension becoming unsustainable. I doubt anyone listening seriously thinks this government or any subsequent government is going to be flush with our money.
Mm.
We've just come out of the biggest, deepest recession for 100 years. Teachers and firemen, amongst others, have been striking about the erosion of their pension benefits. So everyone is feeling the pinch. Demographically, the population is ageing. But there is another huge issue that's come increasingly into focus because of our ageing population, and which also impacts on the state's ability to fund pensions. Can you guess what it is, Paul?
No,
he's gone blank. We may all be living longer, but we need really expensive medical help
to do it. Yeah.
In the UK, medical help largely comes in the form of the good old NHS.
Mm.
But everybody knows NHS funding is at crisis point. And it's been at crisis point for many, many years. And the crisis will become even more acute and critical in the years to come. We do not have formal healthcare rationing in the UK yet, but some drugs cost an absolute fortune. I heard about one course of medication which for a single person cost the NHS 60 grand in a year.
Wow.
Alternatively, with that same 60 grand, 10 people could have had hip replacements.
Right.
I'm glad I don't have to make those sort of decisions, because if it was someone in my family that needed the 60k drug treatment, I know how I'd vote.
Yeah.
But then 10 people don't get their hip replacements and live lives of being really uncomfortable or in great pain. How do you sort it out?
Yeah.
With the huge and increasing cost of healthcare and ever-increasing demands for additional state support on every side, the money available to fund state pensions simply isn't there. So to try and control costs, successive governments have been extending the date at which we can access our state pensions. Women were impacted first with state pension age equalisation, and lots of women that were expecting to retire at 60 suddenly discovered that they were going to now be retiring or at least receiving their state pension at age 65. There is now a rolling programme of extending state pension ages. I am, I hate to admit this live, 56 now. And for many years, I expected my state pension to kick in at age 65. A couple of years ago, I got a letter that said I won't now receive it until age 67. The state has just done me out of £22,000 at today's rates.
Right.
So allowing for inflation, even more. And you can't argue, that is seriously big money.
Right.
But there has to be a profound change in the way we all think about retirement. Many state employees have been protected by the fact that their pensions are funded from general taxation. But the recent economic downturn, from which we are only just starting to slowly emerge, has brought into sharp relief the fact that there simply is not enough money coming into the exchequer in the form of taxation to meet all the demands from society. Because we all want some.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a result, the state simply cannot continue to deliver ever higher and more expensive pensions. Retirement ages are getting later. Pension accrual rates, the rates at which pensions roll up if you're in a final salary scheme, are decreasing, and individuals are having to consider alternate methods of funding for their dotage to supplement income. So the question then becomes, if the state is not going to bolster retirement income, where is my and your pension income going to come from in the future? And the short answer is, it's going to have to come from each one of us individually, from the plans that each one of us have made. In a civilised society, there will always be, quite rightly, at least subsistence-level support for the very poorest. But for everyone else, well, we're largely on our own. You'll have to take some of the cash that you work so hard for each month and put it away to save for your retirement. If you don't, when you do get to retirement, you'll be reduced to living on the state pension. And for many people, that will not be a very pleasant experience. Here's a thought. It used to be that certain life stages were regarded as destinations in and of themselves. Being born, starting school, starting college or university, starting work, getting married. They were all regarded as sort of destinations. They were rites of passage. And retirement was regarded as a destination too. You reached 60 if you were a woman and 65 if you were a bloke. You stopped working, collected your state pension if you were lucky. You got a gold watch from your employer and a bit of pension from him as well. And then you trotted off into your new life. And not to put too fine a point on it, a few years later, you died. But as Bob Dylan once remarked, the times they are a-changing. And in fact, they've been changing now for quite some time. And today, retirement really marks the start of a journey. And it's more of a process, as many people are finding they're having to continue to work longer than they expected, at least part-time, in order to sustain their standard of living as they get older. The last factor we need to be concerned about is inflation. The headline statistic for inflation in the UK is now under 3%. In fact, I think it's about 2%. But for older people, the real inflation figure for them is significantly higher, as the things they need to buy, particularly fuel, food and accommodation costs, tend to rise far more quickly than the broader basket of items reviewed when compiling national inflation statistics. So we now know that people are living longer, that the state is less able to provide pensions than ever before, and that costs for those retiring are rising faster than for everybody else. We'll consider what the costs actually are in a bit more detail later on, but I think I need a slurp and you need a rest, so let's have something very appropriate for the weather, a little bit of Katrina and the Waves. And I've pushed the button and nothing's happened, so we will see what happens. And welcome back to Money Talk. It's great to have you with us. We thought we'd turn to a couple of the questions that have flurried in. We've had a flurry of questions for this, our first show. And Peter has asked about auto-enrolment. We're actually going to dedicate a whole show to that a little later in the series. But Peter writes, I run a small web design agency with three staff. I've heard that I've got to auto-enroll my staff on a pension, even though none of them want one. Can you give me a very basic overview of what this is about? Well, the first thing is, it's not optional. In fact, if you do not set up auto-enrolment and auto-enroll your staff, whether they want to be auto-enrolled or not, and whether they tell you they want to be auto-enrolled in advance or not, you've still got to do it, Peter. Mm-hmm. You don't get a choice. Every single employer in the land over the next couple of years is going to have to auto-enroll all their staff into a qualifying workplace pension, and if they don't, they will be fined. So it is a big, big thing. It's not like stakeholder pensions where you had to buy one, put it on the shelf, and if somebody said, I'd like to be in it, you had to sort of make it happen. This is, you've got to set the pension scheme up, you've got to register it with a pensions regulator, and you have to put all your staff into the pension scheme, and you have to take money off them, and you as employer have to pay some money as well. They can then choose to opt out. So it's not totally mandatory at this stage. They can opt out, but they can only opt out once you've put them in. So the fact that your staff have already told you they don't want to play doesn't matter. You've got to set them up and you've got to put them in. And if you don't, there's a fine. It's a huge, huge thing. Are you finding many people are talking about this, Paul?
It's worrying that not enough people know about it. And it's worrying that quite a few people I talk to go, no, that's right, I don't need one of those. And you go, no, you do. Yeah. You have to. And well, that's the bit they go, no, surely not.
It's a real big issue. And there have been one or two very high-profile scalps already, because what they're doing is they phased this in from October 2012. So the biggest employers had to do this first. So your ICIs and your Tescos and the really big companies, they had to do this. And of course, for them, it's not a huge issue because they've got payroll staff. They've got people that can do this stuff for them. And if they've got to put a couple of extra bodies on the payroll to sort it out, it's a real pain and it eats into their profits, but only a little bit. The cost of the contribution starts to make a bit of a dent, but many of those companies had pension schemes already, so it wasn't necessarily such a big deal. But over the next couple of years, all the small companies are going to have to do it. And these companies, and we're talking to quite a few of them at the moment at work, are actually in the situation where they don't have any expertise. And they think, like the people that you're talking to, well, it doesn't really impact me. I didn't do anything with stakeholder. I don't have to worry about that either.
Exactly.
Well, actually, guys, you do. So, Peter, your situation is you probably need to take some independent financial advice. I know a very good firm called Facts and Figures in Ashford. If you want to give us a call, we'd be pleased to help you. But the truth of the matter is that this is a real issue. The good news is it's not going to become a real issue for you for at least 18 months when your staging date will be, because it's going to be a way off yet, because the smaller companies are a good way off yet.
Okay. Are there number thresholds for this, Simon?
There are a number of thresholds. I was worried you were going to ask that, because just as we came on air, I started looking for the book that's got the list of the dates, because I don't carry it in my head, and I couldn't find it. That'll be a subject for another show.
Okay, fine.
But you can actually find out, if you want to know when your staging date is, very easily and very quickly. You go to the Pensions Regulator website, and it's very easy to Google. If you Google Pensions Regulator, it's the first thing that comes up on any computer I've ever looked at. You click on that, and there's actually a question on the homepage, when is my staging date? The only thing you need to know is your PAYE reference number. That's the reference number that the Inland Revenue stick on the documentation that you share with them when you do your payroll and pay your NIC and tax at the end of each month. That reference number, anybody that does payroll will know what this number is. You get that reference number. You usually only need the last two digits, but have the whole thing handy, and that will spit out exactly when your staging date is. But here's the thing. Don't suddenly breathe an enormous sigh of relief and think, oh, it's 18 months away. I don't have to worry about it. Life is going to be so much easier. The reality of the situation is you need at least a year to prepare.
Right.
Because there's a whole pile of stuff you've got to do. You've got to communicate with your workforce. You've got to work out who your workforce is. It's not everybody that's in staff. It's stratified by age and wage. So you've got people that are younger, you don't have to auto-enroll them. If you've got people north of state retirement age, you don't have to auto-enroll them. But here's a question. I'll ask you, Paul, live on air. We'll put you on the spot because you like being put on the spot.
Sure.
What is the state retirement age?
65.
You used to be right.
Yeah.
In fact, it depends what sex you are and when you were born.
Yeah.
Because for some people it's 65. For some people it's 65 on 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. For me, it's 67.
About
and I think actually for you that's wrong. I don't think you're 65.
I'm not anymore.
Or maybe you're older than I thought. But who knows?
Yeah.
But anyway, the reality of the situation is, even knowing what the state pension age is going to be for each of your individual workers is a real fag because it depends on their date of birth.
Right.
Now, it's possible to find it out, but you've got to do it for all your staff. If you've got 20 staff, that's an hour's work for an administrator before you start. And I bet your staff are already working flat out, making your widgets, or, well, in your case, Peter, doing your websites.
Yep.
So the reality is, you are going to have to do this. You're going to have to do it in about 18 months, which means you need to start thinking about it now and doing something positive in about 6 months' time. And you've actually got to be proactive about it. And here's the thing. If you, as employer, do anything at all or are seen to do anything at all that discourages your staff from taking up the auto-enrollment, encourages them to opt out, you face a big fine.
Right.
So if you say, as employer, I can't be bothered to do this, guys. Auto-enrollment's only going to cost me a grand for you, but I'm going to give you a 10 grand pay rise instead. You will get fined, despite the fact you're actually paying huge extra amounts of money to your staff because you've done something that causes people to opt out. You will be fined if you get caught. And as I said earlier, there's already been some high-profile scalps because they want to make people nervous about this so they actually take action. So, Peter, the reality of this situation is, if you don't do something about it, if you don't actually auto-enroll your staff, you will be fined. So take some advice and do something about it, because if you don't, you're going to have a real problem. And if you are an employer listening now and you're going, it's 18 months away, it's a year away, then I respectfully suggest start thinking about doing something about it now. Start doing a little bit of research. Go to the Pensions Regulator website, put in your PAYE reference number, find out when your staging date is, the date you actually have to auto-enroll your staff. Wind it back a whole year. And it now says 18 months on the Pensions Regulator's website. I think you can get away with a year. So now wind it back a whole year and start planning from then. Which means if you're a smaller company, that means even now.
Right.
And if you're a larger firm and you've got 100 staff, your staging date is very soon.
Right.
So take some action, otherwise you're going to have a real problem.
Are there staff threshold numbers in this?
No. If you've got one employee, you've got to auto-enroll them.
Right.
If you are the owner, director, and the sole employee of your own limited company, you're exempt. But if you've got one member of staff who on age and wage fits the bill, which is basically speaking earns over 10 grand, and they're aged over 22 or aged under state retirement age, you've got to auto-enroll them.
Right.
And if they're outside that age, they can ask you to do it anyway.
Right.
So you may have to register a scheme. So it's really important that you start talking to your staff well in advance, otherwise you're going to have a problem. Okay.
Yeah, but you're going to do a whole section on that at some time in the
future. I'm going to do
future.
A whole session on that. We'll talk right through it. We've put a white paper out as a firm,
right?
And I just looked on our website and saw that we've actually got the last version on our website. So I shall rush back to the office and put the latest 2014-2015 version of the auto enrollment white paper that Facts and Figures have put together. So if you log on to the Facts and Figures website at www.fffp.co.uk. after about 3 o'clock this afternoon, and go to our auto-enrollment page, which you can find very easily on the website. If you can't, give me a ring and I'll point you to it. You can download the white paper that tells you all you need to know. But the key point is, we worked out that there are actually around 28 separate employer duties to do with auto-enrollment.
Wow.
A lot of it is to do with accurate record keeping and making sure that you've actually kept records of the people that you've opted into the scheme, because here's the thing, 3 years later, you've got to re-auto-enroll them, whether they want to be in the scheme or not.
Right.
So it's a real dripping tap thing that you've done it. So people that were auto-enrolling their staff in October 2012, in October 2015, are going to have to do the same old thing again. And if they don't, there's going to be a real issue, loads of fines. Does that about cover it?
It does indeed. So bonfire regulations didn't really work too well then, did they?
No. They did kick out a few, but I'm afraid there's still quite a lot.
Yeah.
I've got another one. It's got nothing to do with retirement. We'll get back to the main subject of our discussion in a minute. But this one's from Jackie. It says, "Hello, Simon. I've recently inherited £50,000 on the death of my father. I'm in my late 50s. I have a small work pension when I retire. I have fully invested ISAs and own my own house without a mortgage." Good for you. "I would like to invest this £50,000 for a few years, but I do not want any chance of losing it, so I'm looking for a very low-risk investment. Can you advise what kind of things it would be best to look at?" If I had a pound for every time I've been asked this question over the years, and the funny thing is, there isn't a right answer, because crossing the road is a risk.
Yeah.
We do it every day, and every single one of us thinks it's a low risk activity. You know, you cross the road without thinking about it. If you're a grown up, you just cross the road. You just do it.
Yeah.
Every year, I think it's over 1,000 people are killed crossing the road in this country. Now, if I've got the statistic wrong, somebody will phone up or ring, tweet in and tell me off for getting it wrong. But it's a big number.
Mm.
And for the families of those people that have conducted that low-risk activity, it blooming wasn't.
Mm.
It was cataclysmic.
Right.
And the reality is there are consequences of action, there are consequences of inaction, and it's all a question of balance. And if you balance it right, you can get a really good result. If you balance it wrong, you get a bad one. For example, most people say it's low risk to put your money under the mattress. You can't lose your money if it's under the mattress. Have you heard of robbers?
Mm-hmm.
You heard of burglars? Mm-hmm. If they come and take the £50,000 from under your mattress, it's been nicked. But you thought that was low risk, and it was, right up until the point that somebody walked through your door with a crowbar and took all your money.
Mm.
Now, you can put your money in a bank or building society for deposit interest. That's fine. That is reasonably secure. And with £50,000, you're protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, so you can't lose your money. So that's really good news. But here's the thing. Interest rates are 1.5% to 2% at the moment. Inflation, thick end of 3%. So what you're guaranteeing your safe, low-risk investment or deposit is that your money will go down in value in real terms over the next few years because of inflation. So you ask yourself, what risk am I trying to avoid? Now, you could say, well, what I'm trying to do is avoid a risk of losing my money from some investment crash. Well, I'm old enough to remember 1972, 73, 74. Paul is as well. I don't know if he remembers. But I was doing my homework by candlelight, as we had a three-day week in the UK. Stock market had been going fabulously well right along until about 1972, 73. And then the Arab bloc that have all the oil worked out that they controlled the world. And they still do. And they just said, okay, lads, we're going to double the price of oil overnight. And they did. And the stock markets worldwide fell off a cliff. And in 1972, 73, there were people jumping out of windows in the City of London, people jumping out of windows in New York, because they were losing money on the stocks that they'd invested in. And we had some real problems. But it was only a couple of years later that the economy had readjusted itself and got itself sorted out. So there you were at the end of 1972, and you had £100,000 invested in stocks and shares. Over a six-month period, that money may have halved in value, or worse. You think it's the end of the world and you've lost your socks. Wait another year or two, get back to 1976, and that £100,000 is now worth £105,000, £110,000, and it carried on its inexorable rise.
Mm.
Now, the fact that it could fall at that point and by so much is very scary, and it makes people very nervous, as well it should. And if you needed your money on one of those days when it had just halved in value, then you would actually have crystallized a massive loss.
Mm.
But if you're investing for a few years, as you say here, Jackie, then you don't necessarily have a particular end date. And you can perhaps afford to ride the fluctuations in markets. And I'm not suggesting for a second put all your money in stocks and shares, far from it. But all I am saying is that investment markets aren't quite as scary as some people think when you start to understand them.
Yeah.
And balancing your investments by putting some money in low risk so that you've always got a degree of capital protection within your investment portfolio, and putting some of your money into stocks and shares to give yourself some potential for upside when the stock markets do well, is actually the most sensible approach. And it's very interesting. We tell this to just about every investment client in the firm. A guy called Harry Markowitz got a Nobel Prize for Economics a little while ago now for working out that 94% of overall investment portfolio performance comes from spreading your money around in the trade we call it asset allocation, splitting it between different asset classes, fixed interest, commercial property, different equity markets and the like. By spreading your money around, 94% of all investment performance comes from asset allocation, i.e. diversification. So the answer is, if you're very risk averse, put it on deposit, maybe think about some national savings. You could think about something called permanent interest-bearing securities issued by some building societies. Those are still around. They can sometimes be worth looking at. But the truth of the matter is, if you're investing for a good few years and you don't say how long you're actually thinking about it at this point, then maybe you've actually got to think about broadening your investment outlook to incorporate some of the things that you might normally be a little bit nervous about. Because if you don't, the risk from inflation to your money outweighs all other considerations.
Yep.
It's a really fascinating subject, and I could spend hours just talking about that. And I've got a script to finish here.
Cool.
We said before the break that retirement really marks the start of a journey, and it's more of a process, as many people are finding that they have to continue to work longer than they expected, at least part-time, in order to sustain their standard of living as they get older. The last factor we need to be concerned about, though, is inflation, and we were talking about this earlier. The headline statistic of UK inflation is now 3%, but for older people, the real inflation figure is significantly higher. And we talked about this. All financial planning fundamentally starts with a budget. First, we need to consider accommodation costs. If you're setting up a budget, how much are you going to have to spend in order to keep a roof over your head? If you currently have a mortgage, the chances are it'll be paid off by the time you reach pension age. But think about it. If you've got a mortgage now, will it actually be paid off by the time that you retire? One of the reasons for the mortgage market review we were talking about earlier was the fact that there are an awful lot of people in the UK who have got interest-only mortgages that are due to be repaid in 5 or 10 or 15 years' time, and they have no way of repaying that mortgage available to them. And what this means is that people are going to get to age 65 or age 67, their salary is going to stop, and they've still got a £50,000, £100,000, £150,000 worth of mortgage debt hanging over their heads, and they've got no way of paying it off. So just as a little thought, to do with your financial planning generally, how is your mortgage going to be cleared? Have you done something about it? Because if you haven't, it's going to be a real problem. If you live in rented accommodation when you get to retirement, you'll need to carry on paying rent. There may be some state assistance if you're poor and if you qualify, and it's certainly something to check out. But the rules might change by the time you get to retirement. Can you afford to risk it? It's probably worth putting some of your own money aside just in case. Then you've got to think about all the associated accommodation costs that go along with living in or owning a property. Insurance, maintenance, council tax, utilities, and that's a big one, the gas and the electric, particularly in the wintertime. Then there are replacement costs, clothing, furniture, TV, car. Stuff wears out. And what about general living expenses? When you retire, you still need to eat, clean, and do the garden. How do you get to the supermarket? By bus or car? What about travel and car running costs? And so far, we've just covered the essentials. Then there are the so-called luxury costs, which some still regard as essential, don't we, Paul?
We do indeed.
The TV license, maybe Sky or broadband, and other technology costs. Then there's leisure. Let's face it, you've worked hard all your life. You actually want to have some time off and enjoy yourself. Want a few holidays, day trips out, golf club, gym, society memberships, as well as presents for the grandchildren. You'd hate for them to think you were stingy. In fact, all the stuff you need to spend money on now when you are working will still cost you money, perhaps more, when you retire, if you can afford it. And if you don't start thinking about where this money is going to come from when you're young, you certainly won't have it when you're older, unless you're lucky enough to inherit. But if you're banking on an inheritance and your parents live to age 95 and they had you when you were 20, when they were 20, you could be 75 before you see a penny. So with the cost of living being what it is, will your parents be actually able to leave you anything anyway? What if they lose all their money paying for long-term care costs? It's all a bit of a gamble. Far better to plan, far better to make your own arrangements, far better to have your own money. but it has to come from somewhere. So in summary, all through your working life, you enjoyed an income. That income has probably gone up as you got older and attained seniority. With any luck, your employers probably recognised cost of living rises. But one day, you'll have to stop working. And when that day comes, your employment income will stop too. At that point, you switch to pension income. If you take no action yourself, that income will be coming solely from the state. At the moment, the state pension for a single person is £5,881.20 per annum. You fancy living on that, Paul?
Yeah, I could go mad on that.
That's a sort of a barbie, isn't it? Yeah. And then for a couple, there's an extra £3,525.60. Let's face it, two can live far more cheaply than one. And if you've got no other income, there is actually a standard minimum state pension guarantee, which for a single person is £7,700. So that's a bit better. And for a couple, it's £11,778. And if you earn $15,000 or $16,000 a year or less at the time that you retired, the state pension will probably be reasonably comfortable. You won't have the expenses of going to work or buying work lunches at work and stuff like that. But if you are lucky enough to be earning in excess of $30,000 a year when you retire, and that's close to the national average for those nearing retirement, because national average wages of about $22,000 cover young people just starting out who are very poorly paid, but obviously as you get older, you get paid a bit more. Mm. For people earning $30,000, a move to a $15,000 a year pension is a 50% pay cut. How do you fancy that? Yeah. If your boss walked into your office today or your place of work today and said, sorry, lads, the company's in trouble. How do you fancy a 50% pay cut? I think there'd be a bit of a riot. I've got a couple more questions, but what I'm going to do now is I think I'm going to give myself another chance for a break and you a chance for a break. And we're going to play Paul's favourite song, because if you've seen him on the dance floor.
Perfect face. Mm-hmm. No, I can dance, I can
I don't want to worry you, listeners, but that was for our illustrious producer, Paul, and he demonstrated the very true meaning of that song while we were off air.
Absolutely.
Hopefully, you will agree that I've now made a case that retirement will be expensive and most of us now need to do something about it ourselves. What are our retirement savings options? I had a question emailed in to me yesterday, which is it better to save in an ISA or a pension? To a financial advisor, that's a bit like asking, what is better, a Mondeo or a Vectra? Both are great cars, both will get you where you need to go, but beauty is, I suppose, in the eye of the beholder. On the ISA versus pension question, it really depends on what you're trying to achieve. Individuals may invest up to £11,880 each year into an ISA, and certainly in the 2014-2015 tax year. And in fact, that threshold's just been increased to 15 grand or thereabouts in the budget. Money invested in an ISA is available at any time, and growth and income is largely tax-free. Clearly, anything that stops money from our hard-earned savings going into the exchequer probably has to be welcomed. But the most interesting part about pensions is that for a private individual, there is tax relief on contributions at the highest rate paid within certain limits, as well as largely tax-free growth. So if a private individual pays 10 grand into a pension and he's a basic rate taxpayer, at the end of the first year, assuming 5% growth, that individual will have 13,125 quid. A higher rate taxpayer would have £17,608, Paul, all due to the government's tax subsidy.
Wow, okay.
So while if either of them invested in an ISA at the same growth rate, they'd have just 10,500 quid.
Cool.
So if you want to have a choice between an investment that gives you 17,600 quid and one that gives you 10.5, which one are you going to go for? For the ISA investor, that 10.5 is available in whole or in part at any time. But the catch with pension is, for the pension investor, you can't get any money out until age 55, and then you can only take out 25% of the fund tax-free. While up until recently, the rest has to be invested to provide a taxable income for life. However, next year, courtesy of the budget, on one's 55th birthday, 25% of the fund may still be withdrawn tax-free, but the other 75% may also be withdrawn immediately net of marginal rate tax, which means that this big thing about people going out and buying Lamborghinis and Bugattis and things probably won't happen, because if you take all your money out in one hit and you've got 70 or 80,000 pounds in there, you're going to end up paying higher rate tax on a large chunk of it, 40% tax, when you don't need to. Just leave it to the next tax year and pay only 20% tax. So people won't do that. But it does mean that if you've got a pension pot of 60,000 pounds, you could probably take your 15,000 pounds out tax-free, and the other 45,000 pounds can be taken out subject only to basic rate tax, assuming standard personal allowances. Well, thereabouts. In fact, it's a bit less, but you get the idea. Here's another thought. After 30 years, the ISA, your £10,000 ISA at 5% will be worth £43,000, £72,000 in the pension because of that initial surge in tax relief. So the tax relief available for basic as well as higher rate taxpayers is hugely attractive and should never, ever be forgotten. So if you've got the opportunity to contribute to a pension, you should grasp it with both hands, as the tax relief added to the original investment makes pensions by far the superior savings tool. And here's the thing, going back to Paul's question earlier on, if you are a web designer working for Paul and you're eligible to join an employer's pension arrangement where the employer makes a contribution, and over the next couple of years as auto-enrollment phases in, every employee will become entitled to an employer pension contribution, then, unless you've already maxed out your pension savings, just about everyone should grab the money with both hands. Because in addition to your personal contribution and the tax relief on your personal contribution, you can add the employer's contribution as well. And this makes pensions hyper-efficient and by far the very best way to save for retirement that there is. So Paul, if you're listening and your employees are listening, I'm afraid I might have just cost you a couple of bob, because maybe those staff that said they didn't want a pension are starting to think, actually, maybe it's not such a bad idea. I really ought to do something. So sorry about that. I had another question in. If I put money into a pension, how safe is it? And that is actually a very good question. It's good to try and understand the answer. After Robert Maxwell fell off the back of his boat, I don't know if you remember that, a few years ago, taking with him a lot of unanswered questions about what happened to the Mirror Group's pension fund, the government introduced a raft of legislation designed to protect the pension funds of those people who had money in company final salary pension arrangements. The pension protection fund was introduced, and in most circumstances, the vast majority of the average person's pension in a final salary pension scheme is now protected by that lifeboat. There's a lot of rules about it. You can look it up on the net. But final salary is not the only type of pension scheme in town, and in fact, they're being phased out due to ever-increasing costs. And now, the most common type of pension arrangement, and for the vast majority of people, the only game in time for auto-enrollment, is known as money purchase. And this is essentially a personal savings plan over which the member has total control as to where the money is invested, when benefits are taken, subject to government rules, and when and how contributions are made. With this type of arrangement, there are two types of risk. The first risk is the solvency / integrity of the pension provider. The mainstream pension providers, however, in the UK are massive insurance companies, and they are all hugely regulated. So there's almost zero risk of theft from this type of pension arrangement. And in the unlikely event that there was such a theft or fraud, the insurance companies would move heaven and earth to cover the losses. They don't need the publicity. It actually makes them look good if they cover the losses. But if not, the government-sponsored Financial Services Compensation Scheme, or FSCS, the same one that protects deposits, would also make good any losses in pension schemes. The FSCS is funded by a levy on the whole financial services industry, and it is therefore really useful protection. The other sort of risk with money purchase plans is investment risk, and the other question we had earlier on about that £50,000 was sort of nodding to this. Pension investors can decide whether to invest cautiously in cash and bonds, or more adventurously in world stock markets or more exotic assets. We will discuss the relative merits of different investment strategies in a later programme, but effectively, I usually tend to recommend a two-stage pre-retirement investment strategy. From the time you start saving until about 5 or 6 years before retirement, we recommend pension investors consider a more adventurous investment strategy, so particularly going for equity markets in the hope of growth. Clearly, in the short term, there may well be some bumps in the road with investment fluctuations, but historically, over longer term, the equity markets have outperformed all other asset classes. Now, all financial advisors will tell you past performance is no guarantee of future returns, and units can fall as well as rise, and we know all that. But over a 20, 30 or 40 year term, the balance of probabilities is that equities are going to do pretty well. Right. Don't put all your money in there, spread it around, diversify. Follow the Nobel Prize winner's recommendation. But it doesn't alter the fact that you've got to consider relatively higher risk assets if you want to get halfway decent growth. Stage two, 5 or 6 years before retirement, you need to start thinking about consolidating your position. And as you get closer to retirement and you want to be taking money from your pension, you can't afford any massive fluctuations in value. So at that point, it's worth thinking about switching into less volatile investments, so back to cash and bonds. I say look at this 5 or 6 years before retirement as markets are cyclical, and if you're considering retirement in a few years' time, then you need to look at whether your fund is towards the top end of the cycle, in which case move it all fairly quickly to lower risk, less volatile funds to protect your growth. But if you're near the bottom of a cycle, hang on for a bit, and in the hope that your more adventurous investments will go up in the hope of recovery. Now, clearly we're talking 20, 30 or 40 years hence, and there's no way of knowing if in 10 years' time or even 5 years' time, this is still going to be sensible advice. So the trick is set your investment strategy now based on what you know, and then keep it under review regularly. Have a relationship, dare I say it, with a financial advisor, and actually see them once every year or every couple of years to make sure that your pension plans are on target to do what you need it to be doing. Because if you don't, you're going to have a problem. What you really need to be doing before anything else is actually start mapping out your financial future. Have a look, think about what you're spending now, what you're getting in now, and how much you can afford to save. And then think about what the position is going to be when you get to retirement. Will your mortgage be paid off? Will you be able to afford then to go to Sainsbury's based on the income that you're getting at the moment, or that you're expecting to get when you get to that age? If you're not, you're going to have a real problem, and it is a huge issue. So think very carefully about it. Retirement is a big subject. We're going to come back to pension planning. We're going to come back to investing. We're going to talk about buy-to-let properties in future shows. But it doesn't alter the fact that you've got to plan for it now. So with that, thank you very much indeed to listening to the first Money Talk show, and we'll leave you with a jingle.
Need temporary employment? Call Temp Network on 01892 531 777.
Let's work it to the bone, bone, bone. Come on, work.
Channelradio.co.uk.
Stockyards, running low on self-esteem.